Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Aldana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, do you remember TINA? The acronym standing for There Is No Alternative to Stocks for Investors Looking for Positive Returns? Well, TINA left the building in 2022, and no one seems to expect her to return this year either. With investment-grade corporate bonds offering yields of almost 6% and even 2-year treasuries yielding well above 4%, there are alternatives to stocks this year. We're going to get into it with the director of global macro at a major investment firm. But Valdana, before that, I've noticed it's a new year. I'm still not a member of your professional network on LinkedIn. This week's guest actually is a member of my professional. I think I'm a member of his professional network. I don't know how it works.
I definitely added him because I was looking at his LinkedIn earlier and in preparation for the show, and he has some really great posts about food.
He's a good follower.
He's a good chef. Yeah, he's a good person to follow.
I was going
to
say, you can make a name in social media either with great charts, financial charts, or with good food picks. Let's be honest.
Good food picks are key.
I think he's got both bases covered.
He does have both.
I'm getting hungry. I get hungry every time I see his LinkedIn.
Can I just tell you, I have so many invites pending on LinkedIn now. Even if I try to add yours,
I'm sure
I would never.
You couldn't possibly even find it.
Take me like years.
Yeah. That's the reason I'm not.
But I am friends with with our guest.
All right. Well,
it's Jurjen Timmer. He's the director of global macro at Fidelity Investments. Jurjen, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the food on social media, because you can never please everyone. You know, like, I'll get comments saying, oh, you know, just, you know, what is this, Facebook? You know, just stick to the market commentary. And then,
no.
How about the vegans out there? Like, show me something vegetarian. So you can never please everyone.
Vildada will want some cauliflower, I think.
I love cauliflower. I am vegetarian, so I actually would like to see more vegetables. Yeah.
Absolutely. He did, I think he did beef fondue for Christmas.
I saw that.
Yes.
I did not know that was legal, that you could do beef fondue. You can actually dip the beef in the cheese. This is like a dream come true for me.
It's an old recipe from my mom is a great chef. She's 88 years old. But some of my best recipes are really vintage retro recipes that were hers from the 1970s. And, you know, beef fondue was like a big thing back there, back then. So, you know, most people think of cheese fondue, but beef fondue is a very good social type of dinner. You can have 10 people over. So it's a lot of fun.
I'm salivating just thinking about it.
You should have a party, Mike.
We're going to invite Jurjen to the party.
Yeah.
But I think, all right, Jurjen, let's shift to your recipe for the markets, though. I think, how's that segue?
That's a really good segue. So on one of your LinkedIn posts, actually, you said 2022 was challenging. So I'm wondering what you foresee for 2023. And maybe if you don't want to give a full year outlook, what you see for the next couple months at least.
So 2022 was all about undoing the excesses in the markets stemming from the overstimulated system following the COVID, you know, crash and the lockdowns, and, you know, that whole sorry episode, which I hope is behind us, but you never know with COVID. But, you know, when the Fed went, you know, on the gas pedal together with the Treasury, and we had that 1-2 punch of fiscal monetary stimulus. Obviously, it was needed at the time. It was a very timely, very effective response. It certainly did what it was supposed to do. But I think we can probably all agree that there was maybe too much and it stayed around for too long. The Fed appreciated the supply chain bottlenecks and the transitory nature of that. Obviously, the Fed could not see the Russia-Ukraine war coming, but in retrospect, maybe there should have been more of an appreciation for the kind of the magnitude of the fiscal stimulus that happened that we haven't really seen since World War II. And so 2022 was about taking that punch bowl away in a very big way, and it cost a valuation reset in all markets, right? The bond market, the stock market, the crypto market, the commodity markets, you name it. And so that was 2022. So it was a big valuation reset. Basically, the Fed raised the cost of capital on everyone, homeowners, the government, corporations, consumers. And the bond market, you know, you mentioned Tina earlier, the bond market went back to being a viable competitive asset class, I mean, positively correlated to the stock market, unfortunately for anyone in a 60-40 type portfolio, which is really most of us. But that leveled the playing field that we now actually have a menu of asset classes that actually is more closely resembles what we have historically seen rather than, you know, the last few years. So now we're in 2023. And for me, the big question, and for many investors, of course, is, you know, will the Fed be able to thread the needle by raising rates just high enough to tame the inflation monster, but without causing a severe recession, which would then mean an earnings contraction, which then would point to the risk of another leg down for the stock market. So I think the bond market has largely reset itself. We went from 1% long yields to, you know, over 4.3. We're now at about 3.75 or so. So I think that reset is behind us. But for the stock market, when you look at historical cycles, there are some cycles where all of the reset in the market, all of the bear market basically, was a valuation component. And by the time earnings maybe did start to fall, enough of it was discounted that the market actually was able to rally because price generally bottoms before earnings. That certainly happened in 2022. It happened in 2020, I should say, happened in 2009. But, you know, when you look at the macro data and you look at the inversion in the yield curve, you know, when the yield curve was the most inverted about a month ago, we were at the 99th percentile of most inversion of all time, you know, the most inverted since the early 1980s. And you have a Fed basically saying, as per the December FOMC meeting, that, you know, we're going to go to 5-ish%, which, given where inflation expectations are now via the TIPS market, would be in a, you know, at a significantly restrictive zone. And the Fed is saying, you know, we're going to kind of stay there for a while. And so when you combine that with the possibility or the likelihood of a recession maybe in the second half of the year, which would then cause an earnings contraction, you know, it's not unreasonable to worry that there's another shoe that's going to drop. But again, it's a very much a non-linear type of thing because price does bottom before earnings. I don't know if you remember 2.5 years ago, you know, in the summer of 2020, the market was roaring back, going to new all-time highs fairly quickly after the 35% crash in February and March. And a lot of people were scratching their heads saying, how is this possible? The world is coming to an end. People are dying. The economy is locked down. How can the market be justified by going to new highs? And in retrospect, the market was just filling that lead lag timeline between price and earnings. So it is possible that the October lows were the lows, and that if we get a mild recession or a mild earnings contraction or only an earnings contraction in real terms but not in nominal terms, that we've seen the worst of it, but it is a risk that there is an earnings wave coming in, let's say, later 2023, and that we're not out of the woods yet. So my very safe forecast is that 2023 is going to be kind of a choppy sideways market where we're going to revisit the lows maybe once or twice as kind of the fear grows, that there's an earnings wave coming. But at the same time, there's going to be opportunities. There's going to be a lot of under the surface rotation, I think, like we saw in 2022. I think international markets are looking a lot more interesting. Value, I think, will continue to outperform growth. So I think it's going to be a very, very bifurcated market where at the beta level, not much is going to happen, but at the alpha level, at the second order asset allocation level, there will be opportunities. And I think the 40 side of the 60-40 will be a port in the storm if that 60 side still has another down leg.
It's interesting, Yuri, and I, our colleague Sam Potter in London put together this monster compilation of sort of every strategists or fund managers' predictions for 2023. And that notion that there's a lot of bullishness on bonds, obviously. Some even saying, well, maybe you flip the 60-40 relationship and go 60% bonds or even 65-70% bonds, 35-30% equities. But I feel like embedded in all this bond bullishness is this notion that inflation has peaked, might not get back down to that 2% level this year, but it's going to head in that direction. We've seen the worst of it. I just get nervous when I see a consensus like that, where everyone's sort of thinking the same thing. It makes a lot of sense that that should happen. I think, you know, if you're forced in your career to make predictions for the coming year, that one makes tons of sense. But how big of a tail risk or regular risk is the idea that inflation isn't as under control as everyone hopes it is? You know, is there a risk there that's not really being appreciated?
Yes, I think that is correct. And if you look at the TIPS market, and the TIPS market is by no means always correct. No market is. I mean, any market is just a subset of human behavior and human expectations. And so market signals are often wrong, which, of course, is a risk for the Fed when they look at financial conditions. But that's another conversation. But it seems like a no-brainer that if we're going to have economic weakness, and now that inflation is coming down, I mean, it is, right? I mean, the CPI peaked at 9% year over year in June, and it's, you know, it's well off of those levels. And most economists that I follow, and even our in-house economics team, it seems fairly likely that inflation will continue to come down, at least till about 4%. But as you point out, the risk is that it stops there, or that it doesn't go all the way back down to 2%. And one thing that the Fed has been very clear about recently is that it's not enough just to see inflation come down. It has to come down to the Fed's target, which is 2% PCE, which generally the CPI runs a little higher than that because of the different composition. So basically 2.5% on the CPI is the Fed's target. And the risk is that, you know, the Fed will go to around 5% in the next, you know, 3 months or so. I mean, the Fed's been fairly clear about that. The dot plot suggests the same thing. But there's a disconnect between what the forward curve, you know, the SOFR curve or the Fed funds curve, is saying the Fed will do, and what the Fed is saying the Fed will do, right? If you look at the 2023 dot plot, the median dot is like 4.375 or so, and the Fed funds curve or the SOFR curve is at 3. I mean, that's a big disconnect, right? And so I think the risk is that, and I think the Fed sees this, is that the Fed wants to contain inflation all the way back to its target, because if it doesn't do it now, even at the risk of a recession, then it may never be able to do it unless, you know, unless much more severe measures are taken. And imagine we do go into a recession second half of this year, and inflation goes all the way to 4, which is, of course, a hell of a lot better than 9. But that's then the trough. And let's say inflation then accelerates in the following expansion off of a base of 3 or 4 instead of, you know, what normally would be 0 or 1, right? Because the pendulum is always swinging through that average target. And I think, you know, I mean, it's a conversation for another time, because we're very far from that happening. But that would create the risk that bonds are indeed no longer a port in the storm, because if you think about where the term premium is, which is around 0 or so, and let's say that inflation does become more embedded at a higher rate, even if it's only 3 or 4, it's still, you know, almost double what the Fed would like to see, then you could see a period of structurally higher real rates and nominal rates. But I think for 2023, the focus will be more on recession risk and the 40 starting to negatively correlate again against the 60, which is what has happened in the last few months again, although it's only a few months.
Right. I do just want to pause and say it's the year 2023. Finally, people are talking about SOFR. It's taken a while. Finally, the secured overnight financing rate that replaced LIBOR. Are you impressed with it? You're not as impressed as I am.
Because I bug you with these topics all the time where I email you. I'm like, what does this mean?
So well,
all the time.
SOFR's huge now going forward. We're finally out from under the shadow of LIBOR.
We've been talking about it for years.
Very exciting.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Well, Jurjen, I wanted to ask you if you feel that we've definitively made the switch from worrying about inflation to worrying about growth, and what it is in terms of economic signals that you're tracking that might sort of give you clues in terms of whether or not or how severe of a recession we get.
Yes, I think for 2023, that is correct. Maybe in 2024, we'll be worrying again about inflation. But for now, clearly inflation is on a decelerating track. We see this in, you know, home prices, used car prices. I mean, you know, price of energy commodities, the PMI, prices paid. So all of those numbers are heading in the right direction. Of course, the Fed is focused on the labor market, which remains very tight. But I think for 2023, the big question is, you know, last year, the first shoe dropped, which was the valuation reset driven by the Fed driving the cost of capital higher for everything. And remember, all assets are really just the present value of future cash flows, whether it's a bond or, you know, a rental property or a stock. And so when the discount rate in that discounted cash flow model goes up, the present value of those cash flows goes down, even if the cash flows themselves are still growing. And that really, in a nutshell, is what explains what happened last year. So that I think, is largely in the rearview mirror. When you look at past economic cycles or past bear markets, even the really, really bad ones, like the financial crisis, the dot-com bubble, 1974, all of those rarely produced a rate of change in the PE ratio that was more negative than what we've seen in 2022. So it's really, it's a stretch to me to argue that the PE ratio is going to go down even more than it already has, right? It went from the 20s, mid-20s to 15. But the PE is only as good as the E, of course. And so the E is what the question is for 2023. Will that E hold up? And maybe it holds up in nominal terms because of inflation, but not in real terms. Maybe it doesn't hold up in either. But when you think about disconnects, and you mentioned earlier about the bond market where everyone seems to be bullish, you know, another disconnect is that it seems like a lot of people are worried about a recession. But you look at the earnings estimates, the aggregated estimates, and I get mine from my Bloomberg terminal every Friday. It still points to positive expected growth in 2023. And, you know, I would be a lot happier, it sounds silly, but sort of wearing my contrarian hat, if the earnings estimates were really bad right now, because then you have a sense, okay, investors are underpaying for, you know, what could be a positive surprise if we end up getting either no recession or a mild recession. And that's one of the disconnects that kind of worries me a little bit, that that's something that's not apparently in the price. The PE is, but the E still is kind of hanging in there. And that, I think, is what, in a nutshell, 2023 is going to be about, is will the E hold up?
Right. Especially in those further out quarters in the year. You know, it seems like everyone seems to backload the growth for in EPS towards the end of the year. And slowly that gets whittled down, perhaps. But Jurjen, one post of yours really caught my attention because it talked about both the 200-day moving average in the S&P 500 and just the basic trend line. And for listeners who aren't aware, basically, if you take a chart of the S&P 500 and you start at the record last about a year ago, almost exactly last January, and just connect the top of the chart going down, it's just a straight trend line down. And what's really been fascinating is that any sort of rebound in the market over the past year has failed right at that trend line, and if not the 200-day moving average, a similar trend line, though not as straight. For a lot of fundamentally minded investors, that's a hard thing to swallow. You know, how can you draw a simple trend line and have it work? You know, is it really that simple? So I'm curious, you know, how important are the technicals these days, specifically that trend line? Is it really that simple? And do we need sort of some big fundamental change of tides to break that trend line?
Well, you ask a great question, and it brings me back, and I hope you don't mind me digressing for a moment, but it brings me back to the start of my career, which is like almost
just a few years ago, right?
38 years ago, I started in the business. Working at a bond desk of a Dutch bank in New York, ABN Bank, which became ABN AMRO. Then I ended up running that small bond desk. So my history starts as a bond geek. But I got really into charting and technical analysis. And that still is in my DNA today. But, you know, then 10 years later, so in 1995, so almost 28 years ago, I was hired by Fidelity as a chartist. I we have a chart room. Tom Keene always speaks very highly of that of that whole history and legacy. But I was hired as a technical analyst, and I quickly found out the hard way, I guess, that I was catering to an audience of mostly fundamentally oriented portfolio managers, and they all look at charts, or at least many of them do. But if I, you know, back in the day, I was an analyst, and I'm knocking on doors, trying to, show, ideas to people like Bob Stansky and George van der Heijden, and, people running the really big funds. And, when you're a one-trick pony and you just have a chart with some lines drawn on it, the conversation is going to end pretty quickly. So I realized that that technical analysis is important. It's a very important complement to other analysis, but you need to have, technical analysis to me is the when and how much part of the question, but the fundamental side is the what and why, right? And so I think to your specific question about the S&P peaking, you're right, January 4th of 2022 at 48.18 on the S&P. From that peak until the low in October 13th, you look at all the little countertrend highs, you draw a trend line, and the last one held perfectly, and that was also at the 200-day moving average. And by the way, if you look at a chart of kind of the overall liquidity in the market, it's not a chart that I created, I've seen it elsewhere, but you take the Fed's balance sheet minus reverse repos minus the TGA, the Treasury General Account, and it's that same line, right? So I think technical analysis is used by a lot of people either as something to confirm or deny a thesis. But for instance, for the CTA crowd, which had a banner year last year, I think it actually provides actual signals. You say, okay, I'm long, I'm going to sell at the declining 200-day moving average, especially if there are other technical features that complement that. And so I do think that there is a cohort of traders and investors who actually will use those indicators as ways to execute trades. And the nice thing is, you know, if a moving average is kind of a confirmed resistance point or a downtrend line, and you sell against that trend line, you know very quickly if you're wrong. And right for CTAs or hedge funds, that's the name of the game. It's risk management. So if you sell at 4,000 and it goes to 4,100, well, then you're out, and then you'll wait and see what happens next. And so I think in that sense, these technical tools are still very, very viable tools for trade location and timing. But from my perspective as a longer-term investor, it's really there to confirm or deny a thesis and to help with kind of trade sizing and timing and things like that.
Mike, do you know where you can find the best technical analysis?
Why don't you tell me?
In crypto.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what it's all about.
Because
right?
You can make up chart patterns. What? I've seen the Bart Simpson chart pattern.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Yuri, one more quick thing, and you kind of made me think about this when you talked about your career started 38 years ago. One thing you hear a lot of people say these days is, oh, these so many fund managers, strategists, traders, whatever today are young. They haven't worked through a high interest rate environment like you saw in the 80s, to which I often reply, well, yes, but they've also been working with high powered computers their whole career. You know, they're able to back test stuff much more quickly and efficiently than anyone could back then. But I'm wondering how you think about that notion that, you know, there's this generation of investors, fund managers, market participants all over the place who haven't lived through this type of inflation shock that we've seen. Have you noticed any sort of, you know, effects of that already, or anything you would suspect going forward, or is it just a bunch of talk?
No, I think it's important, and it doesn't just pertain to inflation. It's just, you know, market cycles in general. You know, like, so I've been around for a while. I've directly experienced a lot of cycles. And I remember, like yesterday, the Greenspan 1994 cycle. And that doesn't mean you can't be a good strategist or investor if you weren't around back then. But for me, as a strategist, especially one who is, you know, very visually oriented, I find it very helpful that the more cycles I've experienced, the more context I have in my head, because, you know, you kind of, I can look at this cycle and say, you know, no cycle repeats exactly. Like, that's not how it works. Every cycle is unique in some way. But we kind of borrow different things from different cycles, right? I mean, the 40s is one area. I mean, I wasn't around back then, but that's one major cycle that I have kind of used as an analog, because that's the last time we had this huge double-powered fiscal monetary response to, you know, to an event, which back then was, of course, the U.S. Entering World War II. But 94 has some parallels, the way Greenspan kind of went nonlinear in and how often and in what increments he would raise rates. And of course, the 1970s are their lessons learned. The late 60s and, of course, the late 90s have things in common, even though they were totally different periods in time. But they had a lot of speculation in what today are the meme stocks. But back then, it was the space stocks or the dot-com stocks. So an advantage of having a long experience is that, you know, even if you don't directly remember it, it kind of rings a bell saying, you know, this kind of feels like that. So whether it comes down to inflation or just appreciating what happens in a recession, we used to have recessions every 4 or 5 years, right? That's why it was called the four-year cycle. But over the last couple of decades, we've had recessions only one every 10 years or so. And the Great Recession was the last one. And actually, that creates the opposite kind of confirmation bias, because people think a recession, they think of recession, they think of the financial crisis, even though that was a perfect storm that only happens, you know, every 100 years or so. There are much milder recessions that we can look at, like 1990, like the dot-com period. So it's a limitation, but as you mentioned, you know, we have lots of information, a lot of it that I get from my Bloomberg terminal. You guys have done a great job building that arsenal of data. And this is one of the reasons why I make my stuff publicly available on Twitter and LinkedIn, because even though it's proprietary, of course, it's our IP. I think if it helps everyone make better decisions, then I think we all win in the end.
Well, Jurriaan Timmer, head of global macro at Fidelity, great to catch up with you and hear your thoughts. Well, Donna, maybe he can get us a recipe for cauliflower fondue. I don't know.
Oh,
I will make it and I will tag you on the post. How's that?
Absolutely. But before we let you go, Jurriaan, we do have to get to our tradition here, the craziest things we saw in markets. I'm going to get us started because our good friend Twiggy Sunday, he tweeted at me, Vildana, a Reuters video. It was about the Saudi Arabia Camel Festival.
Oh, we've talked about this before.
The King Abdulaziz Camel Festival, 45 days long. It features daily auctions of camels.
Okay.
Now, camels are big in Saudi Arabia. They like to race them. They have them as pets, transportation, everything. And according to this video, at least, an ordinary domestic camel goes for about $4,000. But it's time to play, Jurriaan. The price is precise.
The price is precise. 2023's first price is precise.
Price is precise.
Not what? The price is right, Jurriaan.
Absolutely not. No. Completely different game. What do you suppose the highest price ever paid at auction for a very nice camel?
Ever.
Ever. According to the Reuters video, at the King Abdulaziz Camel Festival in Saudi Arabia.
Was it in the past year?
I do not know the date of it, no.
Oh.
No.
Shoot. Okay.
But I do feel like there's a bull market in camels in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Okay, I'm going with $375,000.
$375. Jurriaan, what do you think? What do you think the highest price paid for a camel at auction in the King's Camel Auction in Saudi Arabia?
If you go over, I win.
So the average you said is $4,000?
That's sort of the entry. That's your entry level camel, you know?
Entry level camel.
Yeah, yeah.
It comes down to the PE ratio of camels. Right? What is the peak PE ratio?
Or maybe there's some hump rate, you know, analysis you can do.
If during the dot-com bubble, the PE of a NASDAQ 100 stock was 100, where normally it would be 20, that's 5x. So but that's only 20,000. That seems too low. I'm going to say 100,000.
100,000. 5.5 million.
What?
5.5 million.
Cow. Okay.
Remember,
holy
they raced.
Camel.
Holy camel.
Holy camel.
Oh my God.
I think four grand's kind of a bargain. I wonder if I could get one shipped over.
Should we go?
Brought it to work. I think we're going to. Well, yeah.
We should go.
Will you put in that ticket to see if we can
I'll
go.
Put in the ticket. Right. Yeah. Wow. I'm so shocked by this.
And thank you, Twiggy Sunday, of course.
Of course. Thank you, Twiggy. Okay. I'll go next. So you probably saw this, but 14 years ago this week was when the very first Bitcoin block was mined.
Okay, 14 years ago?
14 years ago this week. And since then, this is a story courtesy of Joe Weisenthal, who I think is your seatmate.
Roommate, yes.
He sits,
we don't sit in the same seat.
Oh.
That would be awkward.
That would be awkward, yeah, because you have competing podcasts. But since then, Bitcoin is up 169,070,6971%.
Wait, how many commas in that? A million percent?
Three. No, there's three commas.
Gee, wow. A billion percent?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Because it was trading for like...
Pennies.
It went from a penny, basically, or a fraction of a penny to 68,000. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, you're in, you know, Fidelity's made a big inroads into crypto. What's your thoughts after this, you know, just disastrous year for crypto going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what we've seen and certainly what's in the headlines now, you could argue that doesn't really even have to do with crypto. Like that's that's a story as old as humankind, but it happens when you have a newly developed market that is unregulated or underregulated and that, you know, has a lot of promise, gets a lot of people excited, but the lack of regulation also creates the opportunity for fraud. And you know, that's a very old story that keeps getting repeated, but just with different circumstances. And you know, when I look at this year, I kind of think back to 1999 and 2000. You know, it was a different technology, but there are similarities, right? And that translates not just into crypto, but the meme stocks in general. And it just shows you that speculation, you know, people learn from their mistakes, but they don't learn it for very long, or the next generation then has to learn it from scratch, and that's why these bubbles tend to be spaced a couple of decades apart. I think there will be, you know, there is still a future. I think there will be another wave coming. I don't know when it happens. Usually when you see the kind of winter that we're seeing now and that we saw, for instance, in 2001 and 2002 for tech stocks, it does take a couple of years for kind of those animal spirits to come back. I think, you know, the next wave, when it happens, will be the one that's based on hopefully prudent regulation that gives, you know, institutions and other investors a sense that, okay, the water is safe in that sense to play in. And then it's a question of, you know, again, using the dot-com boom and bubble as an example, is which tokens or which assets are the pets.coms of the 1990s and which ones are the Apples and the Amazons?
Yeah.
Because Apple and Amazon and Google, well, Google was launched after, but those all had very large drawdowns, but they all came back, and Apple is now 17% of the NASDAQ. Yeah. And so I think it's separating the ones that are, you know, that are long-term market share leaders from the ones that were kind of a flash in the pan. I think that's being separated right now, of course, as we speak. And the fact that Bitcoin, even though it's down a lot, is still there. And what's happened, you know, of course, in the rest of the space, if anything, is justification for why Bitcoin was better than all the other stuff. Yeah. So I think all of that will be sorted out, but these massive cycles take time to play out.
Do you think a much lower interest rates are a prerequisite to get those animal spirits going again?
Well, so, you know, for crypto assets, of course, it's all about the network, and I'm glad you just mentioned that. And certainly for Bitcoin, it's about the adoption curve, right? And I've done work on this looking at, you know, God knows, railroad miles, you know, from 150 years ago, or, you know, or cell phone adoption or internet adoption. And so Bitcoin and other cryptos follow that adoption curve. And that curve is going to grow on a micro level because of the use case of the token or the asset. But it can certainly be sped up or slowed down by macro, right? And so the macro was very favorable in 2020 because, you know, the money printer stuff and all that. And of course, it was very unfavorable in 2022. And so I think the macro of real rates and Fed policy matters because it can speed up or slow down the adoption curve. But ultimately, the adoption curve has to grow on its own.
Right.
And so those are the two dimensions that I look at.
Right. Vildani, you know where animal spirits are always present? The camel market.
The camel market. That's
good. You didn't see that one coming.
Oh, I was trying to find something clever to say back. Wow. That's good.
Well, Yurian, how about you? Have you seen anything crazy in markets this week?
Well, the year is still young, so not so far this week, but We've certainly seen plenty of crazy stuff. And part of it, I think, is the result of the machines taking over the short-term flow, right? If you think about how much of the options value in the S&P has a maturity or an expiration like less than 48 hours. I mean, that we used to never see that happen. And so it creates a lot of volatility. And I remember, you know, the October 13th low, which so far is the low for the S&P. I don't know if it's going to stay that way. But in the 2 days, you know, we had that very big reversal. And I think the S&P was up something like 7% in 2 days. But the meme stocks, you know, the Goldman Sachs non-profitable growth basket, I think was up 28% in 2 days. And that's not normal. And that's the machines, right? Yeah. That is the algos and the machines taking over. And I think it's important for regular investors not to get kind of swept away by that, thinking like, oh my God, something's happening and I'm missing it. But no, it's options and machines and stuff like that.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Yurian Timmer, head of global macro at Fidelity. Really great to catch up with you, and I hope we can bring you back again sometime.
Great. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heyrich is at Vildana Heyrich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.